The World is supported in part by listeners like you, and for a limited time, if you join them and make a gift to The World, your donation will be matched. That means double the support for our in-depth coverage of the day's top stories, brought to you with context, perspective, and heart. Donate today at theworld.org/match, and thanks. In 2019 marks 400 years since Africans were enslaved and taken to the English colonies.
Most African Americans, you know something is missing and you want to be united with it. If you have any level of awareness about your own identity, where you came from.
Today we go to West Africa. And for all you deal lovers, happy Black Friday. In France, there's a push to get rid of the big shopping day.
We communicate a lot about climate disasters, of this overconsumption and this overproduction.
Also, a better way to count penguins.
When you zoom into these images, you can actually see the penguins themselves. The images are so high resolution.
It is such an incredible idea, really, isn't it? Counting penguins from space.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Friday. We've been watching as political unrest has intensified in Iraq over the past few days, culminating today with the resignation of the prime minister. Let me get you up to speed. On Wednesday, demonstrators set fire to the Iranian consulate in the southern Iraqi city of Najaf. Yesterday, with tension in the air, Iraqi security forces shot and killed more than 60 protesters in cities across the country, the bloodiest day yet in this uprising, which has been underway since last month. Then today, Iraq's top Shia Muslim cleric condemned the use of force and called for a new government. Iraq's Prime Minister Adel Abdelmahdi stepped down shortly after. Laith Kuba is a senior advisor to Iraq's Prime Minister and is currently in London. How surprised are you by Abdelmahdi's announcement?
I was not surprised at all. The Prime Minister had to go. He should have gone based on the advice given to him by many people, including myself, weeks ago. But I think he's a shrewd politician. He thought he can hold on. Obviously, he reached the end of the road. Now he's out. There is vacuum, and there are big, big questions on what's coming next.
And what was the significance of Iraq's top Shia leader, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, basically condemning the use of lethal force against protesters and calling for a new government?
Well, just bear in mind, for 1,000 years, Najaf and the previous Ayatollahs had kept a tradition of not intervening in politics unless there is a crisis of a magnificent scale. For them today to come explicitly to ask Parliament to do something, it just indicates how bad things have reached.
Do you expect the resignation to de-escalate the violence of the protests?
Yes. I think on one hand, for them to basically say, well, at least we forced a change in government, that's a good sign. I think that will help calm the protesters. But on the other hand, if the alternative proposed to them is more of the same system from the same people, then the protesters will certainly escalate their campaign and they will demand more radical changes.
Right. I mean, that's what we've been hearing from a lot of the protesters, that it's not just about removing a prime minister. It's about replacing an entire system. So do you know who is expected to succeed Abdelmahdi as prime minister?
Once the prime minister submits his resignation formally to parliament and it's accepted, then the president, Dr. Barham Saleh, will be holding power until the parliament agrees a new prime minister. There will be basically, let's say, two major blocks whose agreement brought Adel Abdelmahdi to power last year. One block is led by a group that is close to Iran, and another block is led by Muqtada Sadr, who is, let's say, more independent from Iran. So if you upset the groups that are aligned with Iran, they have the capacity to sabotage the system, and vice versa.
You're a senior advisor to the prime minister. Is your job secure?
I was an independent advisor to him and to the prime minister before him. I am certain I will continue to contribute as I did before the current prime minister and hopefully in the near future.
Let me just go back to what happened on Wednesday with these protesters storming the Iranian consulate in Najaf, the holy city of Najaf, and set it on fire. How significant was that, especially in light of the city's symbolism to Shiite Muslims?
I think it is significant, but more importantly, it's an exclusively Shia city. And Iran has a very strong presence in Najaf itself. So the fact that the public outrage has reached that point sends a very, very strong message. I think as people reject corruption and reject those who are associated like with crime, they're rejecting the Iran with it. That's what's happening.
Leif Kuba, senior advisor to Iraq's prime minister, who has just resigned. Thank you for your time.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks. Bye-bye.
This week, iPhone users on the Crimean Peninsula noticed something different. Two apps from Apple, Maps and Weather, now label Crimea as Russian territory. Russia took over the peninsula from Ukraine in 2014. Much of the world still does not recognize the annexation. In the rest of Ukraine, Crimea remains labeled as Ukrainian territory on the two Apple apps. The Ukrainian government, though, is denouncing Apple. So how exactly should map makers deal with these political boundary disputes? Joining me now from Scotland is Mick Ashworth. He's a cartographer and author of Why North Is Up, Map Conventions and Where They Came From. What is the normal protocol, Mick, for creating maps of areas with disputed borders?
The primary considerations are just what is happening on the ground, largely, so that you've got to consider a lot of sensitivities. There are obviously sensitivities on both sides of a geopolitical or territorial dispute. Cartographers generally would tend to look at what the de facto situation is, what's actually happening on the ground. They'd look at how widely recognized that territory is and the definition of its boundary. And they'd also consider the view of where they're publishing their maps. They'd look at the view of their own government as well, which could vary from publishing domain to publishing domain.
So when you see these kind of disputes, like outside of Crimea, how are they usually handled?
Well, they're dealt with as fairly and as neutrally as possible. I edited the Times Atlas of the World for a long time, and we had to be incredibly careful in how we represented things and not being careful not to upset too many people. You can't please everybody all of the time, obviously. There is an interesting aspect to this Crimea story just now. There's a lot more flexibility within the digital realm for Apple and Google to show things differently depending on where their users are logging in.
When it comes to national borders, what are some of the strangest borders you've seen lately in maps?
There's so many that are sort of contested in one way or another, and the more you look into where boundaries came from, the more you see why there are issues now. So I've been looking recently at quite a lot of the origins of international boundaries in Africa, for example, when after the scramble for Africa, the slow and steady appearance of new borders across the continent is fascinating, and the fact that they were drawn by officials hundreds of miles away from where the borders are gives you an insight into just why there were problems there and why there are continuing problems in many parts of the world.
What about disputes over place names? I know this is a whole different subject, but like Ukraine has given some people trouble over the Kiev or Kiev, E or Y debate. And now it's like, how do you even pronounce it?
Yeah, it has. And names are right up there with boundaries as to one of the most contentious issues to deal with. And my understanding is that although Google don't show Crimea as part of Russia, they do use Russian transliterations of the local names for Crimea rather than Ukrainian name forms as well. So they're maybe hedging their bets a bit there. But this issue of choosing the right name form is fraught with difficulty. And as soon as a place is named by cartographers or is named by its owner, in theory, it does add credence to their ownership of the place. Because it can deeply affect the people living in those areas. The Persian Gulf is a case in point where the Iranians insist that this should be called the Persian Gulf everywhere. Arabic countries refer to it as the Arabian Gulf. Other publishers call it the Gulf. And there's all sorts of sensitivities about what it implies in terms of ownership and control.
Right. And one's decision to use either Arabian Gulf or Persian Gulf immediately lands you in a political camp. You're in Scotland. Is Brexit going to give you some new map-making opportunities?
Who knows? But I mean, I'm not arguing for such change, but such geopolitical change across the world is always good for cartographers. I would say that.
Mick Ashworth is a cartographer. He's in Scotland. Thanks very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Enjoy Black Friday while you can, if you're in France, that is. France adopted an amendment this week that would ban ads around this massive day after Thanksgiving shopping spree. Even though France does not celebrate Thanksgiving, the amendment is part of the country's anti-waste law. And Christine Carpentier says Black Friday is disastrous for the environment. She's with Envie, a French environmental group that started the anti-Black Friday movement they call Green Friday.
We are really proud of this political awareness. We pushed to raise this awareness because as Envie and as Green Friday, we communicate a lot about climate disasters, of this overconsumption and this overproduction.
In the U.S., Black Friday has become the day where you can get deals and discounted prices on holiday gifts like toys and gadgets and clothing. It's really important for people who don't have a lot of resources, and it's a way to get ahead on holiday shopping. If people are going to do the shopping anyway, what is wrong with that?
I don't agree with you. Most of the time, it's just propaganda and lie because we have, you know, very active non-profit consumer organizations in France, and they observe the reality of this prices reduction. And they let us know and publish studies. Most of companies who participate in Black Friday announce 70% of price reductions. But in the reality, it's less than 2%. You know, it's a real problem because there is a huge communication. It looks like propaganda, but there is a gap with the reality.
Over the past few years, I know there's been a growing concern about overconsumption in France, but France also has its own weeks-long sale events in the summer and winter, Les Soldes.
Yep. So Les Soldes, exactly.
What makes that different? What makes that different from Black Friday?
They are strictly regulated by law. That's why politics want to ban Black Friday, because it's a question of law.
So Black Friday essentially is this big sale day that's not even regulated in France.
Yes, at the moment it's not allowed. However, it happens. That's the point.
So, Anne-Christine, is it your hope that eventually Black Friday just disappears in France and other parts of the world and also in the U.S.?
No. We don't want people to feel guilty in buying what they want. It's a kind of freedom, of liberty. But I wish people can have the good information to buy more responsible and more ethical.
So that's kind of the philosophy. I'm looking out of our studio window at a big sneaker store, and the parking lot right now is packed, people trying to get deals. So what would be your advice on how to be a better consumer?
Okay, then, when you buy something, never buy it because the price is lower. Ask yourself, do I really need it? And then buy things that can last and that can be repaired.
More sustainable.
Exactly.
And Christine Carpentier with Envie, one of the groups behind Green Friday, an anti-Black Friday initiative in France and Belgium. And Christine, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
The French may not want Black Friday, but when it comes to Thanksgiving leftovers, they are nailing it. Head to theworld.org to find out how they do it. And speaking of leftovers, yesterday I was texting a Korean-American pal of mine in L.A., who's also a big foodie, to wish her happy Thanksgiving. And she texted back, just put three necks and the giblets from two friends' birds on for stock. Turkey juk by nightfall. My pal is Leon Han, and Leon, you wrote me this morning to say that the juk is all gone. So, first of all, what is juk?
Juk is rice porridge. It's generally sort of bland. It's like the little black dress of the culinary ethno sort of world.
So it's a great way to use Thanksgiving leftovers, specifically turkey. And you were explaining to me that, I mean, it's not just a Korean thing. Everybody seems to embrace it in Asia. Why does it seem to cross national Asian boundaries?
Well, it's all about the rice. It's the way to make the staple ingredient last longer and go further.
So how'd you make your juk this year?
This year, my juk featured several dollops of really good fresh sesame seed oil, poached duck egg, flash fried shallots, fresh scallions, cilantro, and a dollop of fish sauce. It was delicious.
Oh, man. So if it's all gone, what are you having tonight?
Tonight it's going to be black mole turkey enchiladas.
Long live the turkey leftovers.
That's right, baby.
My friend in Los Angeles, Leanne Hahn, thank you. Good to speak.
Thanks, Marco. Talk to you soon.
Coming up, cats and the birds that hate them. You're with the world. A quick note before we get back to the show. We're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we have the opportunity to receive $20,000 in matching funds to support our reporting. But we need you to join us and support the world to get those matching dollars. Your gift today will go so much further. It means double the support for our unparalleled coverage of issues like immigration, the environment, global security, and human rights. Reporting that you can't find pulled together in a single place anywhere else. Make a contribution today to support the global journalism you rely on. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The times I've been able to take a leisurely stroll through European cities, there's something there that you just don't find as often here in the U.S. They seem harmless. You may even bend down to pet them. But European cats roaming the streets, it's actually illegal in most places on the continent. The reason? They're killing birds. So cats need to stay inside. Researchers at Tilburg University in the Netherlands analyzed nature conservation legislation across the EU. Ari Trauborst, an associate professor of environmental law, says the law is clear. Birds must be protected.
Member states are supposed to implement a system of strict protection, and that involves a prohibition on the deliberate killing of any birds.
Okay, as the owner of two cats, I believe that when people let their cats outside, they're not deliberately telling the cat to go and hunt birds. Cat's gonna cat. But the EU Court of Justice says while that may be true, cat owners are responsible for knowing that their cat may go kill a bird.
So it is the obligation of the member states to have this prohibition in place in national legislation and also to effectively enforce them, so to really ensure that no killing takes place.
A 2013 study by the Smithsonian and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimated that roaming cats kill more than 3 billion birds every year, and that's just here in the U.S. That's 3 billion with a B. In Europe, the legislation to protect birds is clearly not being enforced because, as we've seen in Europe, cats are everywhere. The bird protection law is being enforced for other animals. In the Netherlands, dogs are not allowed to roam free and chase wildlife. If they do, there's a fine. Trauborst and his team found only one reason for the blind spot towards felines.
So many people have cats and have strong feelings about this issue, and there's not a single political party that wants to take this up and lose voters.
Yep, don't mess with a cat vote. And while we're in the bird counting mood, if you've got little ones in the car, you may now turn up the volume. All right, everyone, how many penguins do you think there are in Antarctica? Think about all those penguins you saw on Happy Feet. Now think about the entire Antarctic continent. Would you say there are 100,000 penguins? A million? 5 million? 50 million? I'll give you a few seconds. All right, the answer is roughly 5 million penguins in Antarctica. Yeah, I know, that's a lot of penguins. I say roughly because penguin colonies are difficult to count. Penguins don't exactly hang out in the easiest to reach places. But the BBC's Martha Kearney went to Antarctica. Here's what she discovered about how to get a handle on just how many penguins are actually there.
In the olden days, there was only one way to see how penguin colonies were thriving. You had to physically visit and count them. But times are changing.
So I'm opening up the double doors, and there's a pit in the floor of the aircraft with a hole in the belly, and the mapping camera is pointing vertically downwards.
Well, I've come over to the aircraft hangar now, to a plane that's called a Twin Otter. It's on skis, which means it can fly and land in very difficult conditions. And I've come to meet Adrian Fox from the British Antarctic Survey.
What we're doing is we're applying mapping techniques to counting the populations of adelie penguins along the Antarctic Peninsula. There are about 500 known penguin colonies, but many of them haven't been visited for maybe even decades in some cases. The advantage that we have with aerial photography is that we're flying up 2,000 feet above the penguins, so we can definitely count the individual birds, but it's a non-invasive way of doing it. We can do a lot of penguin colonies in one sortie.
Adrian Fox's camera maps penguins from around 2,000 feet, but actually they're being observed from far higher than that, in fact, from space, as I discovered back at the British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge.
So these are high-resolution satellite images of penguin colonies in Antarctica.
Dr. Peter Fretwell from the team which tracks penguins.
But actually, when you zoom into these images, you can actually see the penguins themselves. The images are so high resolution.
It is such an incredible idea, really, isn't it, counting penguins from space?
Well, yes, but it's very, very useful because penguins, especially things like emperor penguins, breed in exceptionally remote and challenging, harsh conditions. So actually getting people out there, even getting a plane out there, can be almost impossible.
And what has your research been telling you about these populations?
So if you go back 10 years, we didn't know how many colonies there were or where they were. But now, using satellite imagery, we've been able to double the number of colonies we know about. We now know there are 52 or 53 colonies. Half of those have been found by satellite imagery.
The discovery of colonies sounds like good news, but in fact, these animals are facing an unprecedented threat. Dr. Phil Trethern is head of conservation biology.
Emperor penguins breed on sea ice. In a warming world, we'll see a reduction in sea ice, possibly by as much as 30 to 40%. And in that context, there won't be sufficient sea ice in some areas for them to breed.
So in effect, what you're saying is emperor penguins are under threat of extinction.
That's right. With the climate scenarios that we're likely to see over the course of this century, then we will lose substantial elements of the emperor penguin population. 30%. That is really significant and worrying.
And Peter, let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Why does it matter? Why would a world without emperor penguins matter?
Well, that's a good philosophical question. Why does it matter if a species goes extinct? Why does it matter if any species goes, or many species go extinct? Would you like to live in a world where we have no penguins and no rhino, no elephants, no orangutans? And I certainly wouldn't like to see my children growing up in a world that is much less rich, much less diverse than it is at the moment. Because once they're gone, we can't bring them back.
And out on a boat, I had my own penguin sighting with meteorologist John Law.
If we just look...
Oh, yes.
These are some Adelie penguins. They're just tiny little ones there, just a pair of them just stand on the sea ice. They seem quite intrigued by us more than anything else.
It's however often you see them, their walk is so comical, isn't it?
They are. They waddle around and slide across. When they do that on their bellies, it's a great thing to see.
The BBC's Martha Kearney reporting there from Antarctica. Ah, technology. It makes our lives easier and harder. Sometimes modern gadgets seem to have a mind of their own. Take this moment, for instance.
There's no snow in the forecast.
There's no snow in the forecast. That blurted out by an Apple Watch. The man wearing it was a BBC meteorologist who was on live TV giving a weather update with snowy shots in the background.
To get sort of almost blizzard conditions like this, even in places like Minneapolis and Denver, and Denver's very high up.
There's no snow in the forecast.
Oh dear, well that's
your watch?
Yeah, that's my watch saying there's no snow in the forecast. Goodness,
did you just
for that.
Trigger that?
Well, obviously it was listening to what I was saying. Apologies for that, that was not part of the plan.
Thomas Schaffenacher took to Twitter and said, "I never summon Siri." In Schaffenacher's defense, his watch was likely giving a local forecast in the UK while he was busy talking about weather in the US, where there is lots of snow. Right, Siri? No, don't answer me while I'm talking. The U.S. National Weather Service is warning against travel today through Saturday night across big stretches of the American West. So use common sense and stay safe out there. You're listening to The World. In Ghana, an archaeologist works to reveal a legacy of slavery and finds more than she expected.
I wouldn't stay here after nightfall, after dark.
Do you know what you're scared of?
Ghosts, yeah, ghosts. People hear sounds, people hear footsteps, people hear crying.
I'm Marco Werman, echoes of the slave trade 400 years later. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. For many of us, Thanksgiving is a time for reflection, not just on the year gone by, but on where we are as a nation and the people and events who got us here. This year marked four centuries since the first enslaved Africans arrived in what is now the U.S. It was the start of slavery in this country, with a legacy still present today. The descendants of those enslaved people have been returning to Africa to visit and, in some cases, to live. There they've met other descendants of people who, in some cases, abetted slavery. The World's Rupa Shenoy traveled to Ghana and found the two groups grappling to understand their past.
When Black Americans come to Ghana, they visit the last place their African ancestors stepped foot here. White stone castles on the beach. They were called slave castles. Elmina Castle was one of the busiest.
When I think of the conditions of the dungeons, the cells.
Cynthia McCroy's here on a mission trip. She's from Omaha, Nebraska, and is descended from enslaved Africans who, she says, might have been held at this castle.
To treat another human being that way, I can't imagine. Sorry.
Oh, please, can we go inside?
A tour guide ushers us into one of the cells where prisoners were kept. It's the size of a big walk-in closet. We have to stand uncomfortably close. The ceiling is low. Suddenly, the room goes dark. The only light comes from around the edges of the door. The guides unexpectedly shut it. The tourists look at each other nervously. It doesn't last a minute before the guide opens the door.
Condemned cell.
Condemned cell, the tour guide tells us. This is where the captive Africans who wouldn't stop resisting were kept as punishment. As we shuffle out, I fall into step with Ampson Hagen. He's one of the few Americans here, a grad student from the University of North Carolina. He was here before, when he was a kid.
So yeah, having to crouch down. You know, when I was small, I didn't have to crouch.
Ampson's here with his dad, James, who's Ghanaian-American, and a retired high school social studies teacher from Maryland. As we walk from rooms where captives were kept to the offices and chapel above, James Hagen questions our tour guide closely. He says when he was here before, the guides didn't tell the full history, and he wants to make sure they do this time.
Okay, one question.
Have something to say?
Ampson is chuckling because apparently his dad does this a lot.
Okay. Were the slaves who were left here, were they in chains?
The guide says they were only put in chains when they were taken out of their cells, and they were led through a door that he shows us. It has a plaque above it that says Door of No Return, and it's intentionally narrow, so captive Africans had to walk out one by one, from near darkness to sudden blinding sunlight. Ampson examines the door and shudders.
Think about all the work and mental labor that I went into constructing this place so that it was efficient for its task. It's pretty, you know, remarkably awful.
Our guide mentioned something about pregnant women being among the Africans held captive here. James Hagen speaks up again.
Being here for 2-3 months, how were they, the females, why and how were they able to be pregnant? And who made them pregnant?
Yes, who made them pregnant? How did they get pregnant? Definitely somebody might have slept with them.
The guide says what James Hagen was aiming to get him to say, in a benign way, that the European slavers were the ones who slept with the captive African women. Then the guide moves on. Ampson Hagen breathes a sigh of relief. He says once, when a tour guide got to this subject, the guide pointed at him. Ampson has lighter skin than most Ghanaians. He gets it from his mom, who's a lighter-skinned Black American woman descended from people who were enslaved.
He singled me out. I don't remember who was in the group. I was young. But I remember him saying, you know, this is how you end up with individuals who look like you. I said, okay.
So that's what I remember.
It's just one example of how the experiences in these slave castles can be very personal and deeply affecting for Americans, many of whom come here seeking something.
Most African Americans, you know, you know something is missing and you want to be united with it. If you have any level of awareness about your own identity, where you came from, you would have to start asking those questions.
Mona Boyd owns a tourism business for African Americans traveling to Ghana, in Ghana's capital, Accra. She grew up in segregated Arkansas under Jim Crow and remembers her parents whispering about lynchings in the kitchen early in the mornings, thinking she couldn't hear. In sixth grade, though, she learned there was another place where people who looked like her lived in pride, not fear. Some visitors from Tanzania came to her nearly all-black school.
This was like, wow, meeting the queen to us.
Mona's been drawn to Africa ever since that day. She was part of the beginning of a wave of African Americans to visit Ghana after its independence and the civil rights movement in the U.S. Mona came here after she graduated from Boston College as one of the first classes of African Americans.
We were constantly, my generation, trying to prove to white people that we were good enough, we were smart enough, that we deserved to be there. That was a huge big burden. We had to prove that to every white person we went, every job we had. But after I had gone through those castles, I didn't care what you thought. You just couldn't define me anymore. To be honest with you, I just felt I am from an incredible group of people. We not only survived this slavery, we thrived. We fought and we thrived. You know, and it made me feel so proud, a kind of proudness I'd never felt before.
That just made it more jarring to realize that Ghanaians saw that history very differently.
Most Africans, when I came to this country, would not admit that this even happened. It was like it didn't happen. You know, they just couldn't talk about it. They couldn't admit it.
We'll come back to Mona. But to understand what she experienced, I went to see a local historian who's also a former mayor of Accra.
My name is Nat Amatefiu.
People around here affectionately call him Uncle Nat. I asked him to go back to the beginning, to when the transatlantic slave trade began. Uncle Nat explains that leaders in this region had a lot of gold, and word got back to Europeans. In the 1400s, the Portuguese showed up here with guns.
Primitive guns, but guns. With guns, you had vastly a superior form of intimidation. It made a hell of a difference.
There was already a domestic slave trade when they arrived, Uncle Nat says, although slavery didn't mean what it came to mean in America. Enslaved people had some rights and opportunities. Still,
the system already existed. The Europeans saw it and thought, we can try these people in our lands in the New World.
But Uncle Nat says the Europeans weren't going out and capturing Africans. They couldn't. They got sick and died from illnesses like malaria. So some African ethnic groups went into business, warring with other groups, so they could capture prisoners they sold as slaves to the Europeans. Uncle Nat says they were organized and intentional about it.
To pursue slavery successfully, you need a highly organized group because somebody has to go out there, somebody has to locate the victims, somebody has to lead an army there, somebody has to capture them, transport them to the selling centers, all the time keeping an eye on them to make sure they don't revolt, and then sell them and move on.
Anyone could be captured and taken. Eventually, the Portuguese were replaced by the Dutch, then the British in Ghana. Then, around the world came the abolitionist movement, the French Revolution, and increasing revolts by enslaved people, all spreading ideas about equality and humanity.
Of course, when the slave trade was abolished, it was a result of a long negotiations with slave owners in Europe, as well as with slave owners here. The big slave-holding nations also demanded repayment.
The British went from being at the center of the slave trade in Ghana to, after abolition, patrolling the coast to make sure no illegal slave ships got by. They made treaties with African chiefs to protect them from other ethnic groups in a series of wars. Uncle Nat says the British used those agreements to eventually declare themselves the colonial rulers.
They hoisted a flag and claimed that they were now sovereign.
It was 1874. During British rule, Uncle Nat says the African role in the slave trade was deliberately forgotten.
There is a willful amnesia about the roles that we played in the slave trade. A willful amnesia. Our chiefs and peoples decided, all right, we will not talk about it. Don't ask, don't tell. They created a mythology that we were innocent bystanders. whose land was raped by Europeans.
The British ruled for 80 years. In 1957, Ghana broke away and declared independence. Uncle Nat was in his first year at university. He and some friends were asked to serve as guides.
So I remember when they asked us, so who was sold? We said, oh, only the bad people, thieves and drunkards.
They were just making it up because they didn't actually know what had happened.
Especially since the history had never really been taught. And what history was taught was very sanitized. It was a disaster. A lot of African Americans were very disappointed to find this kind of blasé attitude.
And that's how Mona Boyd reacted. After visiting Ghana after college, she went back to Boston and met her Ghanaian husband, Eric. She went into real estate. Eric was in IT. Soon they were both making six figures, living in a brownstone in Boston's historic South End, where they could walk to the symphony.
We were trying to get pregnant when the Rodney King thing happened.
The three police officers facing felony criminal charges were among a group of 15 who stopped a 25-year-old black man last Saturday night, then beat him, kicked him, and clubbed him, unaware that an amateur photographer was recording the incident on videotape.
It was 1991. She remembers watching that video of Los Angeles police beating King after a traffic stop.
I remember just weeping, weeping, weeping. And I said to my husband, I'm not going to get pregnant if you don't agree to move back to Africa to raise our son. Why should we raise our son here when our son can go to your country where he will not be marginalized in any way? He can be king.
Her husband agreed. Their son Selassie was born later that year. Ghana was emerging from a period of military coups. Mona and her husband waited until the country had a successful democratic election. Then they moved when Selassie was 18 months old.
I was able to let go that conscious thought about race. Is it race? Is it my color? I was able to leave that. And it was like having a psychic burden taken off of your shoulders. And you could just move.
Mona didn't realize she had more of that psychic burden to shed until a few years later. In 1994, then-Ghanaian President Jerry Rawlings apologized for the African role in slavery. Other leaders and chiefs slowly followed Rawlings and gave their own apologies.
I wish at this point to particularly to apologize deeply on behalf of the chiefs and people of Gold Coast and Ghana for the atrocities, the cruelty, the inhuman treatment that were committed 400 years ago by my ancestors during the Atlantic slave trade.
And it just made me feel so much better. I stopped feeling resentful, you know, towards Africans about slavery, because I knew that Africans had collaborated big time. You know, it was always in the back of my mind, and it always created a trust issue. And a little bit resentment was always there.
She's helping other African Americans have a similar healing experience. Her company takes tourists to a northern village that used to be a notorious slave market. There, Mona has arranged for the chiefs to hold what Mona calls culturally authentic atonement ceremonies.
It's a very emotional thing that we do because for the first time, Africans are sent to African descendants of the slaves. We're sorry, forgive us.
She thinks that's necessary because otherwise,
you can just never clear this up. You know, you have people hating each other for centuries and killing each other for because there's no reconciliation.
African elders wash the visitors' feet. They eat together. Black Americans get African names. There's drumming and dancing. This year, more than 100 people are going through the process.
They understand, you know, what happened to black people, you know, really what happened and what black people lost. You know, they took the brightest, the best, the strongest from this continent. So what would have happened had those people not left this continent? What would this continent be like?
Maybe, in a way, they'll find out now if more African descendants around the world follow Mona's path. Her son Selassie has chosen to stay in Ghana and pursue a career in music producing, even though his mother would have preferred him to stay in the U.S. after college.
I thought he would have a better opportunity. I thought he would learn faster there, you know. And he said to me, nope, I am not going back there. I do not want to live in a country where they put 30% of the men that look like me in jail.
The reason Mona came to Ghana 30 years ago is the same reason Selassie is staying now. 400 years after the first captive Africans were taken from their continent and enslaved in Virginia, the U.S. still isn't a place Mona's family wants to be.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're reflecting today on 400 years since the first enslaved Africans were taken to the Virginia colonies and revisiting a couple of stories we originally aired earlier this year. Here again is Rupa Shenoy with the story of one woman literally unearthing that past and finding connections to the present.
I met Rachel when I drove out to see her in central Massachusetts. I'd seen an article she wrote about her work in Ghana. Rachel is Ghanaian and English. She grew up in Singapore and is now a professor at Hampshire College. Her article was about finding her own last name, Engman, at a slave castle where she's doing an archaeological dig. So we met and agreed to meet again at the dig site in Accra. That's how I ended up going to Ghana. And that's where this story starts.
Hi. Hi. Welcome to Ghana. Nice to see you.
We meet Rachel Engman just outside and walk together through a checkpoint. Inside is Christiansborg Castle. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The lower levels are the dungeons where many captive Africans died in cave-like cells.
It feels like you're suffocating here.
The Dutch had this place built. In the 16 and 1700s, they used it to transport and sell 125,000 Africans into slavery, most in what today is the U.S. Virgin Islands.
I wouldn't stay here after nightfall, after dark. I always leave at about 5:30, 6.
Do you know what you're scared of?
Ghosts, yeah, ghosts. People hear sounds, people hear footsteps, people hear crying.
Rachel was raised in Singapore and began visiting here in 2005. One of her Ghanaian aunts told her there was something at this castle she should see.
And so she said to me, oh, you know, you're interested in culture, you should go to the castle and see, she said, see your name on the wall.
Rachel found the name in the castle courtyard, inscribed on the side of a water cistern. It said Carl Gustav Engman, 1757. Rachel had heard of a person with that name in her family history, a Danish man who came here when the Danes occupied the area.
I'd grown up with the understanding that he was a missionary.
That was the family lore. But Rachel found Carl Gustav Engman's papers in the National Archives in Denmark.
I discovered clearly he's not a missionary, he was a governor.
For 5 years, that Engman oversaw the sale of captive Africans. He was on the board of the Danish slave trading company, and he owned enslaved people himself. That didn't keep Engman from also marrying an African, Ashokai, the daughter of a chief of the local Ga ethnic group. Engman later returned to Denmark, but not before he and Ashokai started the Engman line in Ghana, the family line that generations later produced Rachel's father and Rachel. She's still trying to understand how she feels about being the direct descendant of slavers.
This will sound like I'm avoiding it, which I'm not really, but I think I need time to process this.
But finding that name in a way tied her to this castle. Rachel wanted to know more about it, and she was looking for a subject to focus on for her graduate studies. She went to the Ghanaian president to ask for permission to do an archaeological dig. We walk through the castle gardens. We reach a trench and find Rachel's team at work. They're local men and one woman. Rachel's trying to recruit more. Many are direct descendants of Danish men who married women in the local Ga ethnic group. Rachel's hoping her team can use the skills they've learned here to get other jobs.
My hope would be that it can help create employment because many of them have not worked since last year when we were here. Not a single day's work because there are no jobs.
One of the team members, his name is Benjamin Odinke Annan, he lives in the neighborhood right next to the castle. We take a walk there.
We're right on the other side.
Originally a fishing village, decades later, it's now one of Accra's most impoverished neighborhoods. People who live here often don't get a formal education. On the beach, there are dumpsters full of trash. The castle looms behind them.
Because of archaeology, I've learned something.
Also, because of archaeology, he has more money. He's sending his three boys, Richmond, Jonathan, and Abe, to private school.
I don't want them to suffer.
I ask Benjamin what he thinks about money being spent to unearth the past on one side of the castle wall, while on the other side, he and his community could really use the cash. He says if the castle's turned into a museum, as the government plans, it'll enrich the whole area, although Benjamin and other workers haven't gotten any guarantees.
here because of tight security.
Rachel shows me the artifacts they've gathered so far that the government hopes to feature in the museum. They're sorted into labeled boxes in her office high in the castle. She's found items from Africa, Europe, and Asia. Some need to go to a lab to be dated.
I can put this under the microscope, and then I can track this trademark. So which country, which city, which town, which manufacturer.
But most of the pieces collected come from the Danish slave period. Some of these items were traded for people.
They would come here, then they would refit the ship, and then take them.
One day, these pieces might help historians understand what the value of a human life was during the transatlantic slave trade. The dig's funded by grants and awards from the U.S.
But it's nice in that, seeing as I find all the funding, I can run the project the way that I think it should be run.
As we walk back to the dig site, Rachel explains that this project could help fill in the broad gaps in established history, an African history that's largely based on European accounts.
So, you know, they're not going to mention a lot of things, but, you know, clearly they were having relationships with these people because otherwise you wouldn't have members of my team with these Danish names or myself with a Danish name. But, you know, they're never going to write in the correspondence going back to Copenhagen, you know, like, oh, I married someone, or oh, I shacked up with someone.
The European accounts usually don't mention the Ghanaians who lived and worked with the slavers, or the thriving local community that did business with them. But the items Rachel's collected show they existed.
And so I think this is difficult for people to accept. Because whenever people want to talk about slavery or slave trade, and we want to talk about African agency, it's always about resistance. And my project is not one of resistance. It's one of collaboration.
Some Africans acted out of self-interest and sold their fellow countrymen. Some Europeans both enslaved Africans and married them. Rachel says it may be easier to think that people who participated in the slave trade were simply bad or evil. But the truth is much more complex. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Accra, Ghana.
Before we go today, we'd like to extend a special thank you to Marguerite Steed Hoffman, who served on our board for 10 years. We are forever grateful for her extraordinary leadership and generosity to the world. Marguerite is a tireless champion of the highest quality journalism, especially stories with a global perspective. Her support has had a significant impact on our work and, we believe, well beyond our newsroom. On behalf of all of us at The World, thank you very much, Marguerite. And that's where we're going to leave it today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.